and welcome to Behind the Panels, the comics podcast that won't rub off on your fingers. I'm David McVeigh.
And I'm Richard Gray.
How are you, Richard?
I'm pretty good. I've had a long, exhausting but hilarious day. So
it has been a long day. I was there for the first part of it with you.
Absolutely.
Did you get
we didn't wake up together? I just want to let people know.
No. We were actually at different locations. We're friendly, but not that friendly.
Not yet, anyway.
Yes, we had to get up very early to go to a screening this morning, but we're here. We're doing it. We're alive.
Why not?
I do have to say that at the screening this morning, forget everything else that happened there, we got to see the Avengers trailer on the big screen.
Oh, on the big screen, I just noticed things that I didn't notice before.
Was it not awesome or what?
And I particularly like the way it turned into a big green rage monster.
Yes. when she said we were going to get an Avengers trailer, I got a little excited at first because I thought maybe it would be a new one, but it was good just seeing that one on the big screen. Yeah. So I was very happy with that. So, Richard, did you do the reading assignment this week?
I did indeed.
Excellent.
As tough a slog as it was, I did the reading assignment.
So I hope everybody is listening who's listening also read the first 8 issues of Sandman, because we'll be talking about that a little bit later in the show. But first, I think we'll do what we usually do, which is just discuss what's been going on in the world of comics. And I thought, let's start off, Richard. I know we both hit the same news article, but I'll cover this one because you've got the next one, which is that Newsarama had an article, which I thought was very interesting, which basically said that... And they're kind of attributing it to the New 52, so we should give them full props. But they're basically saying that direct sales of comics, so this is like the direct distributors to the comic book shops and so forth, this doesn't include comics that you find at supermarkets and things like that. So this is all direct sales, but they're saying that comic books, are DC comics, are now representing 51% of sales, which was remarkable.
I mean, this is the first time that this has happened, apparently, since the Diamond exclusive era began back in 1996.
Wow.
Back when Diamond started, beginning their relationship with comic book distributors. Mm. And all but one of the new 52 titles that launched in the previous month reappeared in the top 300. So that's just amazing.
All but one. Let me have a guess. OMAC?
Probably.
Or Voodoo? Or there's about 5 or 6 that I could actually say I could easily see in the bottom.
But you know what's really interesting? They've also announced that they're doing collected editions of all the new 52 coming up in the first quarter of 2012. And these are like the first 6 issues in either trade paperback or hardcover form. And the only one that wasn't solicited for some reason was Wonder Woman.
Oh, really?
And no one can work out why. Maybe it was just a misprint, but no one can work out why it's left off the list.
That's interesting. I tell you what I would like is they're going to release as a hardback trade all the issue ones of the new 52.
Yeah, now that I will definitely get.
I think that would be fantastic to have. It's going to be $100 and something, though. It's going to be expensive.
Yeah, it'll be worth it. Christmas is coming.
That's true. Okay, the other piece of news in that Newsarama, though, that article also went on to say, and this is the part that warmed my heart, which was that comic book sales in general are 10% up. So,
and that's amazing. I mean, look, you know, comic books have had a lot of PR in the last couple of years because of, well, the movies, let's face it.
Yeah, absolutely.
And this is exactly why they're doing it, to get comic book sales up. So all these gimmicks have actually paid off by the looks of it. So they're not just gimmicks. They've actually got new readers in.
Readership is up. It's fantastic. I'm very thrilled. It means that it's not going anywhere soon. So it's good. I think that we can really thank digital comics as well.
Oh, yeah.
Let's face it, things like Comixology and the iPad and all has really kind of boosted all of this, especially considering that DC is doing everything day and date. And you had a story about this. Tell me about Marvel.
Well, Marvel's going to follow suit. And apparently by March 2012, all of their titles will be day and date digitally as well.
Funny that. I think they're about the last company to do it, because I think Image and I think Dynamite and I think Boom all do day and date. I think Dark Horse does day and date.
Well, to be fair to Marvel, they had been doing some of them. I think Spider Island had been same day digital release.
Ah, the big one.
And yeah, I know. And Regenesis, their books for the X-Men Regenesis stuff had been as well. So obviously they did it with their big titles. But this is something people were complaining about for ages. You know, if you're going to do digital comics, you have to do them day and date. Otherwise, it doesn't count.
You can't be a little bit pregnant. Dive in.
Exactly right.
Dive in, man.
It's a good analogy.
Dive in. The water's fine. All right. Now, you've got me intrigued by a story because as you know, I'm only recently coming back to the DCU.
Yeah.
I was a big Marvel boy. But tell me about the backups.
Well, have you been wondering where the hell is John Henry Irons, a.k.a. Steel, in the New 52?
I
haven't either, but...
actually, I have wondered. I wonder where a lot of the sub-characters are, because there's a lot of characters.
This is the thing. I mean, you know, when they decided to do 52 new titles, obviously there was a gimmick there, because they wanted to keep the same number of titles that they had prior to the reboot, which was mm-hmm. 52 titles. Now, that meant a lot of characters that that already were there... got sort of shunted off to the side because a few titles did disappear in the New 52. And there's a few characters that haven't turned up
yet. Can I say it one more time? Power Girl disappeared.
Absolutely. Well, the thing is, the Super Family was missing a few people. One of these was Steel. And apparently what DC Comics have announced is that he'll suit up again for a new appearance. In Action Comics number 4. So this is starting with the December's releases of comics, basically. So the stuff that actually will hit shelves in December. So the number 4 issues. It's going to be the first 8-page backup story written in Action Comics, and mm-hmm. it's going to be written by, and I'm quoting the Comic Book Resources article here, Grant Morrison's hand-picked choice, Sholly Fish, and drawn by Brad Walker. Now, those of you familiar with DCU will know that a lot of the major heroes over years were actually confined to the backup pages right. of a lot of major comics. Now, Detective Comics, World's Finest, Action Comics, all had like these 8-page comics that would run every month, because you'd have your A story and that would be your B story.
So quite literally a comic strip.
Absolutely. Yeah. But it was usually they're 8 pages. But you got some really marvelous stuff. And if you've ever picked up a couple of the anthologies, there was this one thing that they did, like Alan Moore writes the DCU. And a couple of the things that he wrote were actually some of those 8-page stories. And one of, again, you know, I have to reference Green Arrow once an issue. One of the stories that Alan Moore wrote was actually a 2-part Green Arrow story called The Night Olympics. Right. And it just appeared in the back of Detective Comics, just in the 70s or 80s, I think it was. But this is in fact how actually characters like Green Arrow and some of the smaller characters at the time appeared for a good 20 years. And that was in the backup pages. And I mean, in fact, Green Arrow started out, as did many of the characters back in the early days of comics, back in the 40s, when it was like More Fun Comics and Detective Comics and all these different anthology books that DC had, where you'd get 8 pages of a character that month, and you'd have to wait to get it. That just turn up in different anthologies each month. So this is kind of going back to that tradition where you'll buy a book for the main character, but you'll see the ongoing story of a B character in the background.
I think it's a really good idea because it also limits the number of books they have to produce.
Absolutely.
Because as it stands, 52 is already a great slog. And I think we'll talk in a few minutes about some of the books we might be dropping.
Yes.
Because there are a few that I think I'm ready to drop. And
but it's also that retro thing as well, because the whole New 52, as new as it is, as I said last week, a lot of the stuff they're doing is kind of a big throwback to the pre-crisis heroes. You get these very retro characters in there. So it is this kind of sense of trying to bring back old DC in a lot of ways.
I just remembered something.
What did you remember?
I'm going to throw this in right now because remember when I just before we started recording, people, I said there was another piece of news that I had found out and I couldn't remember what it was. I just remember what it was. I found out what the deal is with Action Comics and Superman.
Oh, right. Yes. Go on.
I know what it is now. Action Comics is set 10 years earlier.
Right.
So they are connected. It says Action Comics is 10 years earlier than Superman. So there'll always be a 10-year gap. So eventually it will catch up to him being in the costume and stuff.
Right.
So that's what it is.
Okay, that's good.
I found that. I went, oh, that makes sense. So it also makes sense because, you know, we were saying that the continuity seems to be all screwed up. Piece by piece, we're starting to put this together.
Okay, so like that's interesting that they've taken that approach. And I suppose it sort of keeps with their idea of either allowing people to jump on board at any point or maybe just, you know, to get a younger, fresher DCU happening there. Mm. Or maybe it is just a more interesting way of taking the thing rather than having four books which are effectively telling the same story of Superman.
Right, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And we also have to look at it and say that there's still issues with their continuity. There's still the issue of the Green Lanterns not quite making sense, and there's still issues of the fact that the Justice League, which I absolutely adore, but doesn't seem to fit into any continuity of any of the other books. So there are still issues that we're waiting, but slowly I think it is starting to piece together in an interesting fashion. And it's not hindering the enjoyment of the comics.
No, not at all. And in fact, in many ways, it's made it far more interesting than the previous TCU.
Well, because you're looking for clues. It's kind of getting interesting. Now, Fear Itself is a miniseries from Marvel that just recently wrapped on its issue 7. Now, we haven't talked about it in a lot of detail. I read it, and I actually didn't like it, and I think we're really going to dig into this at some point. I might actually make you read it, and we might talk about it. Because I was actually quite into it for a while, and then the last issue completely lost it for me. I really didn't like the last issue. I didn't like the resolution, and I didn't like the fact that it felt like a cheap marketing tool. Because at the end it says now to be continued in another series,
right?
So it wasn't like there was a conclusion because you had to move on to another series. It bugged me, but a new comic has just come out, which is The Fear Itself 7.1. Now I haven't read this yet, and because of my experience with Fear Itself, I was hesitant to. Now it's actually subtitled Captain America. So it's called Fear Itself 7.1 Captain America. And you said that there's an interesting thing in there.
Okay, we're going to issue a massive spoiler warning on this for anybody who hasn't read the issue.
Okay, for a spoiler warning, let's do this. All right.
Okay, that's a signal that there's a spoiler coming up, people. Again, David?
Yeah, okay, here we go. And from now on, spoilers.
Right, now, so in Fear Itself 7.1... there was a surprise announcement. This is a book by Ed Brubaker, right, who's written some great stuff over the last few years. Now, just as a bit of background to this announcement, there have been several hints for this coming up. Marvel released a teaser last month talking about a new series that was going to debut in January next year. Mm-hmm. And it was just basically a black background with a red star on it saying, "What if there wasn't only one?" So people were wondering what that means.
I know exactly what that means because it's already happened.
It was listed. It was solicited as the the Brubaker project number one in the things. It's kind of like the solicitation version of untitled, Lars von Trier project. Basically they've announced it in the issue 7.1, on the final page, it had an ad for a new comic coming out in 2012, Winter Soldier number one by Ed Brubaker and Butch Geese. That's not terrible in and of itself, except for the fact that they killed off Bucky.
Again.
In issue 2, was it?
Wait till they get a load of me.
That's what they'll be saying. But you know, the bottom line is that Captain America at the end of Siege, which was a miniseries I quite liked, gave up being Captain America. Right? Right. So he gave up his suit. He became Steve Rogers. And he was basically the head of S.H.I.E.L.D. Spoilers, people. We're in a spoiler zone here, okay? And
you didn't play the theme, David.
So I kind of assumed that we're still in there. But okay. He gave the Captain America suit and persona to Bucky. So Bucky was Captain America. In Siege, spoilers, as you said, Bucky dies at the beginning. In Fear Itself, Bucky dies, and Steve Rogers redons Captain America's uniform again because they need the symbol to go forward, right? So now what you're telling me is that Bucky didn't really die, and now that Steve Rogers again. Is Captain America again. This is, you remember that series we were talking about, Inc., the alter egos, where we talked about this last week? It's one of the things they talk about. There's a whole episode about this where they say it kind of takes the weight out of death if you keep bringing them back to life again, you know?
Absolutely. And I think we actually said, we were talking last night at a movie, and we said we were talking about the death of Gwen Stacy. And why that's so in why that's had such an impact on comics, because she's the only character that stayed dead.
She stayed dead for the last 50 years. She stayed dead. You know, it's like the rest of them just keep coming back. I actually heard a rumor, and I have no confirmation on this, but I heard a rumor that they're thinking about bringing Sentry back. Now, I don't know if you know Sentry, but Sentry was like the Marvel equivalent of Superman. Super duper powerful, flies, all that
that's
sort of
right.
stuff. And he basically went whack job in Siege and was eventually destroyed. And now I've heard a rumor that Sentry might be coming back.
Look, nobody stays dead in the comics.
Except Gwen Stacy.
Except Gwen Stacy. But she's not a superhero.
That's true.
And, Gwen Stacy and Uncle Ben.
Well, that's so true. True. Uncle Ben stayed dead. That's right. Yes.
Anybody associated with Peter Parker
they stay dead.
Stays dead. So you don't look, if you're a friend of Peter Parker,
unless your name is Norman Osborn.
Yeah, exactly right. Yeah. Just be very careful. If you're a friend of Peter Parker and not associated with one of his arch enemies, just tread mighty carefully because you're not coming back.
Yeah. So I think that bringing back Bucky again, considering that this is, what, the third time they brought him back now? Or the second time?
At least the second.
Yeah. For those who don't know what the Winter Soldier is, if you hadn't been following Captain America, basically Bucky, when in the movie, if you've seen the Captain America movie, this is spoilers, so I'm going to play it again just one more time. All right, just in case we're not clear that this is a spoiler. In the movie, when Bucky falls into the, basically falls, it's slightly different in the comic books, but basically he dies on a mission. And you think he's gone. And what you find out years later is that the Russians found him and basically brought him back. And he was missing his arm, of course. He lost his arm in the accident, but he had also lost his memory. And so they basically brought him back. They retrained him. They gave him the bionic arm and all this stuff. And they basically used him as a killing machine. And they'd send him out on missions and bring him back and put him back to sleep again. And eventually, though, his memory came back, and of course, he rejoined the world and came back and joined Captain America. And of course, all these covert missions and all the stuff he did for the Russians made him a better soldier, you know? And so he was this powerful character who could come back into the Marvel Universe years later. So, and it all sounds very convoluted, but it was just an excuse to bring Bucky back.
Yeah, exactly. Right.
And that's kind of how they brought him back. And so now, why would he take that persona back on?
I have no idea.
You know,
I don't know, maybe Marvel are scrambling around in the dark at this point. They thought, wow, DC just did something amazing, and we're kind of at a loss.
Well,
resurrecting
an old character may not be the answer, maybe, you know, trying something.
Particularly when it's Bucky.
It's Bucky trying to do something different and new, maybe, might be the way to go.
if you're ever interested, peoples, take a look at our good friend Wikipedia, and there's a list of dead comic book characters on there. And it's quite an extensive list. More people have stayed dead than we think.
There was that one superhero, and I'm trying to remember his name, who actually died of AIDS. Was it AIDS or cancer?
Oh, yes.
No, cancer. Cancer.
Captain
Marvel.
One comic book character, Jim Wilson, died of AIDS with a Hulk by his side in Incredible Hulk 420.
That's right. No, this was actually one of the superheroes. I think it was cancer. Nikki was just telling me it's Captain Marvel. I don't think it's Captain Marvel, though. That's the DC character.
Oh, no, you could be right there, actually.
Is it Captain Marvel?
Yeah.
It is. I think Nikki's right. I think there is Captain Marvel died of cancer.
And that was a really tragic issue, and it was all very...
And they may have brought him... Yeah, that's where we go. It was Captain Marvel died in 1982 of died of cancer from toxic nerve gas.
That's right. There you go. Did they bring him back?
That was a huge thing because he was like a big character. It was Captain Marvel, except Captain Marvel Captain Marvel. Yeah, 1982.
That's
died
Marvel,
of,
Marvel.
Marvel graphic novel.
Yeah, so Marvel. So it's not the Captain Marvel.
No.
No, not that Captain Marvel.
No. But, but yeah, at least two characters have died of AIDS: Jim Wilson and Shadowhawk, who died in Young Blood number 7.
Mm-hmm.
Here's one in Image Comics. The Freak was suffocated by insects that were created when Spawn took the Freak's inner evils and gave them tangible form.
Oh.
So, like, you know, plenty of different ways to die. Gabrielle dies of complications during childbirth in Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles number 58.
I think we brought back Phoenix at least three times now.
Phoenix will never die.
Yeah, Jean Grey just keeps coming. They just keep resurrecting her. You know, it's like, leave a woman alone. She's done enough. I think, look, you know, we're building this show on the fly, and I'm gonna put this out to the people out there who are listening, because we actually have had people write to us. It's been very nice. I'm going to put this out to the people to say, I think we should just make this show a spoiler zone. Because it's hard to talk about all these books and all the, because there's so much history, without sometimes leaking out some news that might be coming.
Exactly right. And I wouldn't be able to drop in things like Network died on a bus of depowered students struck by a missile in New X-Men 23.
Some days you just can't get rid of a bomb.
Exactly right.
Absolutely right. So I think we should just say at this point that if you're listening to this show, just be prepared the fact that spoilers are going to happen, especially in the reading club.
A lot of people have died here. I'm looking at this list and I'm actually horrified.
It's a bloodbath, people.
Don't get comics at all. Don't read them. They're horrible.
All right, so bottom line is, we got to sidetrack there. Fear Itself, 7.1, Captain America, Bucky's coming back from the grave.
Apparently. I'm gonna keep a good Bucky down.
I'll read it this week and I will report back. All right, tell me about Alexander Payne.
Okay, Alexander Payne, a lot of you will know, directed a great little indie film a few years ago called Sideways, which was one of Paul Giamatti's big great
Has absolutely great nothing roles. To do with comic books, but a wonderful film.
Nothing whatsoever. It's a great thing, but he also has got another movie that's also nothing to do with comic books, pardon me, called The Descendants, out at the moment, which is George Clooney's Oscar contention movie. Mm-hmm. But he has picked up the rights to direct a film based on a Daniel Clowes book. And Daniel Clowes wrote Ghost World, which you'll remember was also made into a film by Terry Zwigoff back in about 2004-ish, if memory serves.
Mm-hmm.
And the book he's picked up is called Wilson. And Wilson seems I'll just read a little bit of the description about the book from the Amazon description, the official back of the book description.
Okay.
Meet Wilson, an opinionated middle-aged loner who loves his dog and quite possibly no one else. In an ongoing quest to find human connection, he badges friend and stranger alike into a series of one-sided conversation, punctuating his own lofty discursions with a brutally honest, self-negating sense of humor. Sounds brilliant.
And at this point, I'm just going to say, love your dogs, just don't love your dogs. No, all right. So, yeah, it sounds like something that Alexander Payne would make.
Yeah, I mean, they're looking for an actor at the moment. And looking at the character, I'm thinking Paul Giamatti might actually be a good...
Of course he will.
They've worked with him before several times.
It's his go-to. It's his go-to guy.
Absolutely. It won't be Alexander Payne's next film. He's making another one called Nebraska between now and then, but he's definitely making this. So it's good to see that he's returning to comics. But interesting little story. So that's just a non-superhero comic book that's making its way to the big screen.
And you know what? We've got to cover all comic books because there's a lot of them out there that aren't tights and capes. So
absolutely. There's one I think we should put on our list for later on, which I hadn't thought of, was one that they mentioned a lot in that Ink comic book, Ink television series that we watched called Love and Rockets.
Yes. I've been meaning I've been meaning to read it for a long time.
Me too, and that's what this show's all about, getting around to reading those things that we never
damn straight
got a chance to.
It forces us to finally get to them. So,
absolutely.
Just very, very quickly, we'll just throw this out there because I don't think we've got a lot of information on it, but Foxtel is showing Green Lantern, the animated series, as of next week or this week?
I think it starts in the States, certainly, this week, I think.
Oh, no, it's the States that's getting it, not Fox. Fox still is getting it, but later. That's right.
Yeah, later. So I think it's coming out in the States this week, and we'll get it shortly. Yeah. It's good to see that we are actually getting it, but look, this is the latest in the DC animated things, as we've said in previous episodes, or issues, rather. the DC animated series are leaps and bounds ahead of anything the other studios are doing televised.
And I've actually liked the last, was it, two Green Lantern one-offs that they've done. I really liked First Flight, and I really liked, what was the one? It was the story.
Emerald Knights.
I really enjoyed that too. So I'm actually looking forward to that. I think that would be a lot of fun.
It's good to see that they're sort of giving some attention still to the Green Lantern franchise, despite the lukewarm response that the film had, and maybe this will parlay into a bit of goodwill, and we might see that Green Lantern movie we still want to see.
Well, they promised us it. I don't know if it's going to happen.
Yeah, well, the next one's allegedly darker and grittier, so the Brown Lantern or something.
they're turning off half the lights.
Yeah, exactly.
All right.
It'll just be green. There'll be no lantern.
All right, we've got to get on our book club here in a second. I just wanted those two quick ones that you brought up, which I had no idea were happening, and I just think they're fantastic. One, of course, is that Victoria is going to be issuing DC license plates, which I think is genius, and I want them in Sydney.
Yeah, and you can get them in Superman, Batman, Wonder Woman, Supergirl, and Green Lantern and The Flash.
And still no Power Girl.
Still no Power Girl,
God
no.
Damn it.
But they're all the 1982 kind of style ones that were drawn by Jose Luis Garcia Lopez and Dick Giordano.
Oh, so those really classic ones. Cool.
Yeah, so they're very retro. They're not the new 52 versions. But apparently they're going to be available November 30th, and they're also bringing out Looney Tunes plates as well.
Oh, Daffy Duck on a license plate. That's a good idea.
Yeah, I want one with Bugs Bunny dressed as a girl.
Yeah, that too. And the other piece of news, now this is the ongoing saga. This is the ongoing saga that apparently Spider-Man Turn Off the Dark, the Broadway musical, you're saying now that Julie Taymor is suing them.
Yes, look, it's ongoing. She sued the musical producers. Apparently, look, the musical is in theaters and it's playing, and it's settled in for the long haul.
I think it actually holds the world record for the most number of previews. Previews.
Oh yes, absolutely.
Because they kept showing
it
previews.
It holds the record for the most number of near deaths or deaths on in a Broadway musical as well. I mean, it's Spider-Man: Turn Off the Dark is now playing on Broadway, and this is of course the famous musical that U2's Bono and the Edge did the music for. Julie Taymor is the director of a number of successful Broadway plays,
including The Lion King.
Including the musical version of The Lion King.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, one of the biggest Broadway shows of the last.
It's just that little show. That little show with the animals, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I don't know if you've heard of it.
Yeah. So
look it up on the interwebs if you're not sure. But the original version of this, like, was an absolute disaster. Apart from having issues with as I said, there were accidents and they kept making adjustments, and there were a long preview season, as you suggested, David.
Yeah.
They eventually retooled it and reopened it. Now, but what she's claiming now is that as the original director and writer of the first version of the show, she hasn't received proper credit and pay. And according to this article, which is on Comic Book Resources, as the lawsuit filed today makes clear, the defendants have violated Ms. Taymor's creative rights as an author of Spider-Man Turn Off the Dark. Moreover, the producers have failed to compensate Ms. Taymor for the continued use of her work to date. Now, I reckon that if I were Taymor, I'd want to be staying as far away from this as humanly possible.
Yeah, because all the bad stuff happened.
I had nothing to do with that. That was your disaster, not mine. So
all the bad stuff happened under her watch. Have you noticed that after she was fired and other people took over to finish off all the development of this schmuzzle of a show, there haven't been any more near deaths? You know?
No, look, I mean, she introduced some crazy characters. A friend of mine who went to go and see the show said it was like what was written by someone who had a contempt for comic books.
Yeah.
And wanted to actually mock them in the things, which is just really not the audience that you're going for. And apparently in the original version, there was a new character by She was some kind of like a woman that they created who had a musical number in the middle of it, just creating new characters when they really didn't need to.
Well, no, and also, I still don't understand. Do you still understand what the title "Turn Off the Dark" means?
Maybe she's sort of hinting at the fact that he can't actually see out of that mask. because it doesn't have eye holes.
I just picture going in there and sitting down in the audience and seeing a guy in a Spider-Man costume come across the stage going, "Where is the furniture? Where is everything? Somebody turn on the lights." Ow!
Oh, Jesus. Turn it off.
Oh, wait. Peter Parker could never afford to pay his bills.
Oh, that's what it is.
That's what it is. Right. Good luck with that, Julie. I think that you're going to lose.
Yes. The
fact that she spent more money than any other Broadway musical in history, I think, to start with, and couldn't get the show open, kind of puts the liability on her shoulders.
Maybe she's just taking a line out of the one of the songs, which is "I just can't walk away." Say it now.
Okay. All right. Let's talk about Sandman.
Pick of the week.
Let's do this. I don't have a pick of the week. What can we do for pick of the week? How about this
one? Up in the sky, it's a bird.
It's a plane.
It's Superman.
Okay, that'll do for the moment. We're building this as we go, people. DJ Jaeger, where are you? You need to do it some themes. all right, so last week we set the reading assignment of reading issues 1 through 8 of Sandman.
Oh, and that big sigh of mine, sorry, was me picking up my copy of Sandman.
I'm just going through the credits here. Hold on a second. God, that takes a long time to get to the credits. Now, I know that Gaiman wrote all of them. Was the art and everything by the same people all the way through?
No. In fact, Sam Keith did the first 5 issues.
Sam Keith and Mike Drigenberg.
Yes, that's Drigenberg. Right. He did the inks. Yeah. And Mark Drigenberg took over after the first 5 issues because Sam Keith left. And you'll notice there's a dramatic change in the art from that point onwards. Mm. And it does actually take on a very different tone as well as a result of it. It gets a little bit more Frank Miller-ish, but we'll talk about that in a moment.
Absolutely.
But we're talking for the purposes of our discussion today. We're talking about the first 8 issues of the series.
Yeah, it's basically the first story arc of Sandman. Kind of, it's the introduction, isn't it? I mean, I guess that's made very clear by the fact that the first 7 issues are all called... what is it? Prelude to something.
It's Prelude and Nocturnes, I think.
Yeah,
it's called.
Yeah. So they're
Nocturnes and Preludes.
Nocturnes and Preludes. They're actually setting this up. They're setting up the world. They're setting up the characters and all that sort of stuff. And I actually found issue 1, which was called Master of Dreams. No, Sleep of the Just. Sorry, Sleeper of the Just. I actually found it hard going to start with.
It's huge.
It's a very long book to start with. It's not the usual 22 to 26 pages that we're used to. It's I think it's like 40 pages. 40.
It's about that, yeah. Yeah. It's also largely a period piece as well.
Yeah, and that's the part that threw me was I started reading it, and I'm going, why is this set in, 1916 or something like that? And
yeah, it starts out in 1916 in Wychcross, England.
That's right. And as you start to read it, though, you start to realize we're starting to go forward in time. And we start to see...
Yeah, and that's for a very good reason. And as we said, complete spoilers in this.
Absolutely.
There is this society of... kind of a secret society of I guess, Mason-like warlocks who attempt to capture death for their own wicked purposes so they can control death and thereby control the world. But they don't get death. They get his younger brother, or Death's younger brother, who is Morpheus, the king of dreams, the god of dreams.
But they don't know that.
No, not at first.
They can't figure out who they've got. They know they haven't got death, but they've managed to pick up, as they refer to it, as a sub-demon that they've picked up. And so they put him in a bottle. Quite literally, they put him in a big glass jar. And they basically just keep him. And the point that as time goes on, one of the people in the story actually says, "Why don't we just let him go?" And they can't at that point because they're afraid of the wrath that he would bestow upon them. So it's safer just to keep him in the bottle.
And their ulterior motive is, of course, they still think that he will grant them with some kind of.
Well, they're waiting for him to break.
Yes.
But he just sits there silently, not talking. and basically not doing anything. And they, quite frankly, it's driving them crazy.
For 70 years. So yeah. It's actually two generations.
And the guy that actually originally does The Conjuring, was it Mr. Burgess? Dies. And his son has to take over at this point. And they've still...
Meanwhile, around the world as well, all sorts of weird things are happening because people are going into permanent sleep and not waking up, kind of having these... and they're not aging either. They're having these dreams that go on forever.
Well, yeah, and...
They're
thinking it's some sort of worldwide epidemic.
They thought it was encephalitis or something.
That's right. And there's actually one sub-story in it, which is a... A child, they are aging, but there's one...
They are aging slowly, though.
Yeah, there's one story, which is that child who falls asleep, basically, and doesn't wake up, and grows to womanhood, and is actually raped, and has a child, and has no idea any of this even happened.
That's right.
And it's like, you sit there going, oh, wow, this is just... Disturbed.
Yeah, and it is actually disturbed is a really good word there, because it's the first, as I said, it's a difficult read, the first issue, because it's all over the place in some ways, and Gaiman himself admits that he didn't quite know what he was doing with the first issue. He'd never written a serialized book before, and he's kind of thrown everything into this first issue that he had in terms of ideas, I think.
Yeah, I mean, you could have literally spread that first issue out over three issues.
The story's still going in issue two.
Yeah, and we'll come to issue two in a minute.
The story is still of that initial thing. I mean, he goes off on a quest over the remainder of the other six issues, but we'll get onto that in a moment. But it's huge, you know, and it could almost work as a standalone story, which I think is quite interesting about that first issue.
Yeah, because you could end it. I mean, if you wanted to do a standalone story. If you didn't add the subplot, which is, of course, that he had three items that were taken from him when he was captured, if you didn't go into that subplot, then you could end this with him being freed, you know, end, and him being freed and saying, well, that's it, you're done, and, you know, taking his retribution, you know what I mean? And he's just sat patiently this whole time waiting to find his way out. But they didn't do that. They continued on with it, and they've actually turned it into this series, which has now been going for how many years? A long time. I think what we talked about the other day, Gaiman wrote something like 76 issues or something like that. So
that's true.
Or maybe more.
Well, this run finished in 1996, so it actually ran for 7 years.
It ran for
75 issues, but then I think they've had so many different spin-offs as well in that time, and since then, and they're still going. They've still got new ones, though. It says House of Mystery, which is where he's appearing at the moment. That's been running since about 2008, and that's still going.
And we should also be very clear that once you reach the end of the second book, you are now in the current timeline. And you are in the proper DC universe. Because we do interact with other people that we know from the DC. Even though it's a Vertigo book, it is within that kind of DCU world. And once we get past... what I thought was kind of a grueling read. I have to say this, beautifully written. Gaiman's words are stunning.
It is, and I've actually pulled out, I mean, there was one passage I wanted to pull out. This is, after all, one of the few graphic novels to ever appear on the New York Times bestseller list, alongside, say, The Watchmen and Dark Knight Returns. But when you've got language like... I rise slowly, approach the stage. Around me is soft susurrus of sound and a languorous, ironic applause. I mean, this is the kind of language that Gaiman infused his comics with. And it's not the sort of thing that you normally see in what is essentially a visual medium. But this is a writer, first and foremost, working. And Gaiman over the years has now actually, you know, really used the visual and written word in ways that no other writer really has. A lot over the 20 years that have followed the debut of this book. But when this came out, it was a little bit confused, but beautifully written.
Absolutely. I think the biggest problems with the first book are structure.
Absolutely.
And once you get over the structure, and once you get involved in what's going on, the first book is kind of like a setup. If you get through that setup, if you're reading a novel, it's like that difficult first chapter where you've got to kind of get into the swing of what the writing is. But it actually does pick up its pace, and it actually does sort out its structure by the second issue. Even though it's still finishing that part of the story, because they're now condensing it, and I think the second issue is back down to the normal 22, 26 pages, and you sit there and you go, now it kind of feels like it's the right structure. Now we kind of feel like we're flowing a little bit, you know?
Well, he actually has a reason after, as you said, at the end of that first issue, he escapes, and then because they've planted in these three objects, basically he'd instilled his power into these three objects, and when he returns home to his dream kingdom, effectively, he finds out that it's in ruins. His castle is gone. His servants may have always been mad, but they seem to have gone a little bit mad. I love Cain and Abel.
I love them. I love the fact that there's that scene where is it Cain who gets killed, and then yes. comes back to life again. It's like, okay, here we go again.
Here we go again. Yeah. I love that. That's a great thing. But you know, and then he realized, but he'd actually infused his power into these three objects.
That's right.
And he didn't realize how much of himself was in those three objects
until
he'd lost all of his power. And so he's got a quest now, which is to go back and retrieve these three objects, which is effectively the first arc of the thing, him reclaiming these three objects. And it takes him all over the DCU and into some very strange and often very dark places.
So the three objects are his helmet,
which is kind of like a gas mask.
Which kind of looks like a gas mask, his bag of sand, and his ruby.
Yes,
which and they say in, I think it's issue 4 when he goes to hell. Is it issue 3 or 4? They say they're his badges of office.
That's right.
So when he actually shows up at the gates of hell, they actually say, "Where's your helmet? Where's your badge? You know what I mean? Where's your ruby? You know?"
And hell is the hell that was written kind of by Alan Moore in the pages of books like obviously Hellblazer and Swamp Thing,
yeah. And speaking of Hellblazer, that was a very interesting crossover into John Constantine's world.
And that's what issue 3 or 4 as well, I think, or whichever the one that isn't Hell. I think after he goes to Hell, he goes and meets Constantine.
Yeah, that's the bag of sand. So that's actually the first one. So that's the first one. That'll be book 3, I think. Book 4, I think. Sorry, book 4. That's his first part of the quest because it was the easiest part to find.
That's right.
Oh, wait a minute. Book 4 is where he goes to hell. Hold on a second. I'm just trying to figure this out. Hold on. Dream a little dream. I'm just looking through the books right now. Constantine is book 3. Right. So
Constantine's book 3. That's right. And it's a corker. And that's really where the series picks up. I mean, one, Constantine's such a great character. And Gaiman writes him so well.
Yep.
Although he kind of writes himself in a way. And it's for those of you who have only ever seen John Constantine in the film version.
Very different.
Very different. The British version of Constantine is brilliant. And it's a very sexy book as well. But it involves – he meets Constantine and asks him to track down the first thing, which is bag of sand, which Constantine had at one point because Constantine gets mystical objects.
Oh, that's right. He actually – before he does that, he actually gets a clue. He calls upon the witches.
That's
and
right.
The witches tell him he's allowed to ask each one of the three witches one question.
One question.
And so he asks each one, where's the bag of sand, where's the ruby, where's the helmet? And he gets kind of this loose answer that he can't get any more detail on. And the first one, of course, was to look for Constantine because that's like his first clue.
Yeah.
For the ruby, he's actually told to look for the mightiest heroes. In other words, go look for the superheroes.
That's right.
And so with Constantine, I just love the fact that Constantine doesn't – I mean, he's scared and he has reservations about it, but he doesn't bat an eyelid about actually going along with it. There's one point where Morpheus actually says, you should go away now. This isn't for mortal people. He goes, oh, no, my curiosity's up now.
Well, it's actually funny. When Morpheus first turns up, he does drop the papers he's carrying because Morpheus just turns up with his thing, and Morpheus says, John Constantine, I presume, to which Constantine responds, well, I'm not Livingstone, pal. Sorry, little joke, very little. That's his immediate response. So, yeah, Constantine isn't easily fazed even by Morpheus himself.
There's a set of five panels that lead up to Morpheus arriving before that line where he's talking. It's like internal dialogue, and you've got Constantine in the first panel saying, for the next few days I kept meaning to investigate this Sandman stuff, I just never quite got around to it. And then throughout the panels he's talking to himself, listening to the radio, blah, and on the very last panel it says, it was on the third day that he caught up with me. I love the way that that's put together. It's a really nice structure.
No, it really is. Well, and the thing that's interesting about Sandman, I think this is true of all the Sandman comics over the years, particularly now that there's a series of spin-offs, every issue almost has its own feel to it, which you don't get. It's kind of like, and in some ways it's sort of analogous, particularly this quest, is a little bit analogous to like a sci-fi serial like Doctor Who, where you, that particular issue, you're... you know, in the future, or you're in the past, or it's a horror story, this issue, or it's a comedy, or it's a or something else. When they're in hell, there's a lot of comic elements to it. There's a lot of really hilarious elements to it. There's also some really beautiful, touching moments. The John Constantine one has those comic elements at the start, but ends on this really beautiful note. By the time we get to issue 6 or 7, I think, which is set in a diner, it's incredibly dark and incredibly
sticky. Issue 6, 24 hours, is brutal. It's just dark, man. That was the diner one. That's the that's when we were looking for the ruby. That's the last quest.
Now I've got to try and remember Dr. Destiny. I'm not as familiar with him in the King, and I'm not sure if he was an existing character in the DCU. I'm assuming he was. I think he was. He's a character that goes back as far as the 1960s.
Right.
In the comics, and he was one of those, you know, kind of standard villains for the JLA. But here they've betrayed him as someone who's was obviously arrested at some stage by the Justice League, and then just thrown into Arkham and forgotten about.
Mm. Well, because he was too dangerous.
And he's gone completely mad as a result of it,
And disfigured and horrible. I mean, he's just the girl that picks him up on the side of the road, or you know, he takes hostage. She says, "Have you got the AIDS or something?" It's like, what's wrong with you? You know, why do you look like that?
Actually, for those of you who don't know what Dr. Destiny looks like, his actual proper costume looks very much like a low-rent Dr. Doom.
Right.
And so he's kind of got the skull face and the hood and the cloak. He looks identical to Dr. Doom in a lot of ways, except he's got a skull mask instead of a...
Except in Sandman, he's naked.
He's naked the whole time, and he is the most disgusting creature. He's almost like Gollum.
That's what I was thinking. He's kind of got this Gollum feel to him.
And the ruby, in fact, is his precious. He's actually gotten, and I wonder if that was a reference for him, because he gets the ruby, which was Sandman's ruby, and it's given him this power, which he's been using, but the power's also corrupted him and turned him into this horribly gnarled golem-like creature.
Well, then there's a line from Morpheus where he says that no mortal was supposed to be using this, and he's been holding on to it for 60 years or something like that. And it's like, it's twisted him. He said, I don't know what damage this has done to him, you know?
And that's right. And that was kind of foreshadowed in the issue with John Constantine, where his ex-girlfriend has had the pouch.
The bag of sand, yeah.
And she's just a shell of a human being by the time they catch up with her.
The helmet was actually being held by a demon.
That's right.
So there was no effect to that demon. That was a great scene too, where he had to play the game.
Yes, that was some beautiful, and that's that line I spoke earlier. That was from that scene.
Yeah, it's beautifully written. He challenges, for those who are listening, he challenges the demon. Well, the demon challenges him basically, because he goes to hell and says, "One of your demons has stolen my helmet." They pinpoint the demon who's got it, and the demon says, "No, it's mine now. And if you want it back, you have to challenge me. And if you win, you get the helmet. If I win, you're in servitude to me forever." And so he goes, okay, and he takes him on, and it's a challenge of words and concepts, and they have to, each concept has to outdo the concept before it.
And so I'll give you an example. I am a dire wolf, prey stalking, lethal prowler. The next move is, I am a hunter, horse mounted, wolf stabbing.
Hmm.
And then he moves on. I am a horsefly, horse-stinging, hunter-throwing. I am a spider, fly-consuming, eight-legged. It goes on like this, and it's, as you said, beautifully written and very visual. So it is a wonderful sequence. And I love that hell issue, because he ultimately wins the quest, and he says, right, I'll be going now. Thank you for being so honorable in hell. And Lucifer, Morningstar, says... honorable, surely you joke. Surely, look around you, Morpheus. The million lords of hell stand arrayed about you. Tell us why we should let you leave. Helmut, I know you have no power here. What power have dreams in hell? To which Morpheus replies, ask yourselves, all of you, what power would hell have if those imprisoned here were not able to dream of heaven?
And then they just part like the Red
and
Sea.
And they just part, exactly. It's and they all part and let him walk out. It's a beautiful moment.
it's stunning. There's a couple of things we should talk about very quickly, which are some cameos that show up across these eight books. I think the weirdest of all the cameos has to be Dr. Crane, a.k.a. Scarecrow, who is also in Arkham Asylum, and is portrayed in this book as almost a buffoon.
A nutjob / buffoon.
Yeah, but not scary at all. I mean, the thing about... you know, the Scarecrow is that he's dangerous, you know? And in this, I mean, the first encounter we have with him, he's hanging from a noose from the ceiling. And then in the next panel, it's a slightly different angle and you can actually see the hook down his back.
Yeah.
hanging him from the ceiling. And he's just having a discussion with Dr. Destiny, like, oh, yeah, well, you'll be coming back soon. We all come back to Arkham eventually. And when Destiny is finally brought back to Arkham, it's like, hey, welcome back. Told you you'd be back.
One of the lines I loved, he had in there something about missing he said, if you see Joker, tell him to hurry back. It is an April Fool's Day with that. He's a little joke.
That's right. No, so it's this bizarre kind of weird atmosphere. There doesn't seem to be any guards around.
No. You know?
It's just this very strange interpretation of Arkham Asylum. And of course, we have him escape from there because his mother dies and he's been given back his ruby, basically. Mm. No, he doesn't. He doesn't get his ruby back straight away.
He gets his eyeball, his amulet,
is supposed to cause him from not being able to be hurt. We don't actually see any evidence of this, but and then he goes searching for the ruby along with Morpheus, who's also looking for his ruby. And this leads to once he gets it, because Morpheus gets to the ruby, but we find out that over 60 years, Dr. Destiny has actually modified the ruby. For himself, and nobody can use it but him.
He gets to it by way of the Justice League International. So we do have who at the time, this is the 80s, this is the period when Justice League America had gone international, had embassies and all that sort of stuff.
That's right.
And so he gets there and he's led there by one of the characters who's almost been forgotten these days.
I was not familiar with Scott Free.
No, I wasn't familiar with Scott Free either. He's one of the people that sort of came from Apocalypse, which was that whole dark side kind of thing.
Right. And also, once again, great humor in that scene.
Oh, it's terrific.
When he goes to bed and he says, and then there's Sandman turns up and he goes, every time I stay at the embassy.
Yeah. and he's looking for one of the old JLA and he says, let me see, who should we see? Batman? No, it's 3:30 a.m. He'll be at work. And so that eventually leads them to John Johns, who is Martian Manhunter.
Yep.
Who falls down on his knees immediately and sees Morpheus for who he is and praises him as a god of old.
Because, of course, he's also the god of dreams on Mars, yes. but under a different name. Right. And so he's recognized. But once again, lots of humor. We have that lovely scene after Sandman leaves and John Jones and Scott Free are walking down the hallway. He goes, come, I think I have a stash of Oreos somewhere we can share.
The thing is, that humor in those two issues sets it up for the next issue.
You need
24
that.
Hours.
Yeah, well, you need it because 24 Hours has no humor.
Has no humor at all. It is one of the darkest books in comic history. Forget Killing Joke. Forget anything Frank Miller's written. Forget.
Absolutely. And what's really funny is it's a slow boil because the first half of the book, nothing really happens. First half of the book is all character establishing. It's all set up. It's all told through kind of the point of view of the waitress. And she's basically saying, I'm a writer and I'm going to write these people. And she's explaining who all the people are coming in and all the stories that she has. And blah. And then about the, actually not even the first half, probably the first quarter. And about the end of that first quarter, she says, and then there's that quiet little guy in the corner. Yeah. I'll have to ask him about himself later on.
She wonders about him is the caption.
Yeah, which is, of course, Dr. Destiny sitting there. And then we start getting his internal dialogue, and basically he's setting them up. He's controlling them the whole time. And there's that one scene, I think, that really, really does help capture that. And it's on page 6 of the book where the young guy is going for a job interview. And at the beginning of the panel, so the very top of the page, he says, I don't believe it. I'm going to be late for an interview. Jesus. Oh, no, no, no. And he goes, ma'am, I'm leaving you $5 on the table. That should cover it. I'm sorry. I've got to shoot off. And then we cut to the shot of Dr. Destiny. And we come back to him and he goes, if I run, I can just about make it. And then he goes, can I have some more coffee, please? And he sits down. And he goes, great coffee. And it's like, he's just been manipulated back into his seat again, you know?
And then you get these series of television shots then, because he asks for the television to be turned on. And it feels very much like a Frank Miller thing. The panels are laid out very much like The Dark Knight Returns.
Yeah, yeah.
And even the art style, and this is a different artist by this stage, looks very much like that kind of really exaggerated 80s style thing. And it's basically this puppet show on television. And clearly Dr. Destiny's got him to this guy to slit his wrists on live on air and encourage children to do the same.
And I love the fact that last panel is it just says, please stand by, we're experiencing technical difficulties. And it cuts to him and he's just laughing.
But then it gets darker and darker after that. At one point, he's being carried aloft on the shoulders of all these people who have gone completely mad at this point. One of them's, you know, cut his finger off and written the words God on Dr. D's chest.
And what is it? There's that one guy who's sitting there and he's getting the waitress to help him nail nails through his hand to the table. Yeah. You know, and you're sitting there going, wow, that's bleak. And what's really interesting is it's split up all the way through it. And it keeps cutting back to a clock that basically would say, hour one, you know, it says like hour one, the flies walked into the web. That's all the people coming into the coffee shop. And then later on, you'll have one that says hour 12, it is time for them to get to know each other better, you know.
And then you get to hour 15, he gave them back their minds for a little while.
Yeah, so they could.
They're also going, why, God damn it, why are you doing this stuff to us? Why are you going to kill us all? Why? Because I can.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then the next four panels are just black and it says murder in the dark and it's a screen.
And it's that one though, I think probably the most one of the most disturbing ones I thought was when basically he has them all fornicate with each other behind the bars and stuff like that, and there's that one shot that's got the three women of the bar and they're singing a song. It says hour 20, it was time for entertainment. And they're singing, and the lesbian chick's basically got her top all open and she's half naked, and there's a severed wrist nailed to the counter. And the waitress is holding the cleaver. Yeah. It's like you're sitting there going, oh, dear. And then the thing that's disturbing about it, though, is that the lesbian character, it says hour 21, he shows them the delights of belief, and she drives needles through her eyes.
Yeah, as you do.
And she's basically going, I can see the glory, I can see the glory. It's like, oh, my God.
And then Morpheus finally turns up. He says, hello, I'm glad you're here. It was starting to get a bit boring.
On this sly little moment, because at about the halfway point, he goes, I don't know what to eat. And then in the very last panel, just before Morpheus turns up, a fly buzzes by, and he just snatches it out of the air and eats it.
Yeah.
You know, they go, really? That's what it was. So, yeah, very, very, very good issue. I mean, it's amazing, but it's not easy to read. It's hard.
No, not at all. But you can tell that Guy Mannett really had a command of the character. And, well, the thing was, it had a command of the storytelling in the comic book form at this point. But the character of Morpheus doesn't appear, as you were pointing out, David, just before we started talking, until basically the last two panels of the book.
Yeah. This is Destiny's story, and it's Destiny's little movement. And all the way through it, I'm going, when are these people going to get saved? And they don't. You know, they don't. It's a very bleak, dark book, which leads to the final chapter, basically, which was issue 7. We have an issue 8 as well, but that's kind of like an epilogue. Where we kind of just wrap it up. But
a very important book, nonetheless.
An important book all the same. But number 7 is basically where he finally stands off against Dr. Destiny.
And, that's right.
Because he can't touch the amulet because Destiny's modified it. But Destiny has now realized that if he does use the amulet on Morpheus, he gets more power.
Mm.
And so Morpheus says, well, if we're going to have this fight, we're going to have this fight where if it's about dreams, then it has to be in the right place. And so he takes him to the dream realm. And I think the conclusion is actually quite interesting. I think it was an interesting finale to the whole, because he can't obviously take on Destiny, but he manages to make Destiny use the ruby to the point where the ruby destroys itself.
Yeah.
Which, of course, frees the power back out again.
And he is fully restored to his natural state by that stage. And there's these beautiful full look. I've got the Absolute Sandman edition here, which are those beautiful giant hardcover books that they do. And the big full page of that where he's got it's Morpheus fully restored, cradling he's got
I love that picture. Yes.
Yeah, and he's got Dr. D in one hand. And says, thank you, John D. It's just this beautiful picture. It's almost photorealistic.
Yeah, no, it's a great image. And I also love this, there's an image later on where John D is little tiny and Morpheus is sitting there with his hands clasped around his knees.
That's right.
And he's tired. Yeah. That whole section, there's about three pages there, which are just really, really, really nicely done. Because even Destiny isn't upset by it. He's kind of like, what happened? you know, the whole gist of the panels is almost like, what the hell just occurred?
And it's like, you mean after what I did, you aren't going to do anything?
He says, are you going to kill me? And he goes, I could. Perhaps I will.
Of course you're going to do something, John D. I'm going to take you home.
And then, of course, we're back at Arkham.
then you get, as soon as they arrive back at Arkham, Scarecrow jumps out from around the corner yelling, boo. And it's just, oh, sorry, hang on, I'm afraid I can't do a thing without my spectacles. And he says, it's a comfort in this wretchedness to have companions in woe. Of course, Marlowe Faust. Of course, he was talking about hell, but it applies equally to Arkham. There's no place like home, Dr. Crane, Professor Crane. Yeah.
It's a bizarre little finish.
But you're right about the writing around Dr. Crane as well. He's completely buddy. There's just a thing. Well, there's a conversation going on between Morpheus and D. Crane's off in the corner going, "I can't go to sleep in my cell. There's a rat in there.
I'm frightened. Yes, it's a very, very, very strange interpretation of Scarecrow, let me just tell you. But I like it. I like it a lot.
No, it's great.
I love the fact that he's wearing a witch's hat.
Yeah. Look, and then after that, that concludes that thing. But there's a epilogue to that, which is another beautiful piece, and it's all done in the daylight of a park, and it's actually quite jarring because there's all these bright white backgrounds to it, which we've not seen before.
This was basically a one-off issue just called The Sound of Her Wings.
And it introduces a character who's basically Morpheus's older sister, who is Death.
And I love the fact that there's even mention in the conversation where he says, you know they were trying to capture you, not me. And she goes, I know. Yeah. And I love there's also a running joke where some guys are playing soccer and the guy kicks the soccer ball and Morpheus just catches it in midair and the guy goes, wow, dude, that was amazing. And when she turns up, the ball comes flying through the air and she just catches it in midair and goes, wow, you're amazing.
And then he starts hitting on her. Yeah. But the soccer player starts hitting on her and says, hey, can we hook up later? And she says, don't worry, you'll be seeing me again. Yes.
And at this point, we haven't actually been told that she's Death.
No.
Which we're actually kind of under the impression at this point that it could be a girlfriend. We don't know who she is. All we know is that she looks like him. She's got that same pale complexion and all this sort of stuff. She's a lot more cheerful than he is. Mm. but then we start finding out that, you know, she's the older sister. We start to find out that she is Death. And they go, and it's a really interesting story because not only is it in the park, but then we start going kind of journeying around and she's just doing her day-to-day job.
Yeah.
While they're having the talk. And she's kind of putting it straight for him.
Yeah, because he's actually quite depressed at this point. He's just finished his quest. He doesn't know what to do now.
And he feels empty. That's right. He goes, I felt like I had something to do before. Now I don't feel like I've got anything to do. And she's basically saying, you know, get over yourself.
And she says, I think she actually says, you know, you finished your quest. You didn't know what to do. And you don't have the sack to go and start something new. Mm. So here you are sitting feeling sorry for yourself being a mopey bastard. So it's a great little issue and I love the depiction of Death in it.
Yeah, I love the fact that she also throws his loaf of bread because he's feeding pigeons. I love the fact that she snatches the loaf of bread and hits him over the head with it. Yeah. Yeah, I love the fact that they've got Death as this kind of rock chick. She looks like Joan Jett.
Yeah. And he's fairly upbeat most of the time.
Yeah, and she's laying in flowers at one point. she's going around basically collecting these people who are died And I love the fact that each one of them at the end of it has this little phrase where it just goes, and then I heard the sound of wings beating.
Yeah.
Where she's basically flying them off to wherever they have to go. And then she's back again and she's talking with him and so forth. And of course we then come to the conclusion, well, he comes to the conclusion that, you know, she's right. He has to get on with it. He's got things to do and he needs to rebuild his kingdom. He's been gone for better part of 70 something years.
Yeah. And then I guess that's where the next, Tales in the Sand is the next, is the next issue after that, which I didn't read.
I only went up to issue 8, but I will be reading more of it now.
Absolutely. And I look, as I said, I've got this Absolute Edition, which I've actually had sitting on my shelf for about 6 months. I bought it in one of those Amazon sales and really, cause it was just so damn cheap and the Australian dollar was so strong at the time. And I love the look of these things. They're these beautiful sort of faux leather bound. They might actually be, it's not definitely not leather bound, but it's a sort of faux leather bound volume, in a giant slipcase, and it's like it's beautiful to look at, and the cover art on the individual issues is amazing, and I'm sure that's a different artist who did the cover art. Yeah,
the cover art is really unique on every one of these.
It is amazing, and I think that I think there is collections of just the cover art out there. So if you're ever looking for just a good piece of art to get. Definitely pick that up. And I think that's one thing we can't forget to mention going through this is that as good as Gaiman's writing is, the artwork in this is also quite beautiful. And after all, comics are a twin medium. The only medium that mixes, apart from, you know, children's storybooks, that mixes words and pictures in the one place so seamlessly.
And movies, funnily enough.
Well, movies doesn't. I mean, in terms of the written word, that you're actually reading things. The way and a great comic book sometimes bleed the words. I mean, you look at the way that the voice bubbles are actually formed in these things, and they're all in quite a unique thing. The way
I was about to say, it's not only the artwork in Sandman, but it's also the layout of the pages is really, really unique. It's beautiful.
Yeah, just it's like sometimes it's a huge splash page. Sometimes it's just panels that curve halfway around the page.
Oh, look, I'm really glad we read this. As I say, I want to read more. I want to go on and continue the series.
And it's a big series.
So it's a very big series. So I will continue on and continue reading. We might come back and revisit it. There was actually, in the middle of the series, I think there was around the issue 20, 22 mark, something like that, there was actually one continuous arc. I think it was called something like Season of the Mists or something like that. We might come back and revisit that or something. We'll see how we go.
Well, there's one issue I really want to read and I'm looking forward to, and no doubt I won't be the only one here because my girlfriend will undoubtedly want to read this. It's an issue written entirely from the perspective of a cat.
Oh, really?
And it's called A Dream of a Thousand Cats.
Oh, cool.
And it looks good. It must be issue 18 or 19 or something along those lines because it's towards the end of this volume I've got.
Yeah, I found it. It's issue 18. It's also followed by an issue that has got me intrigued called A Midsummer Night's Dream.
Yes, and that was, I think it is actually based on the Bard's work. There is some, I think by that stage he's getting far more experimental.
Oh, here we go. Seasons of the Mists is issue 21 through to issue 28. It's a prologue, 6 chapters, and an epilogue.
Right.
So it's another 8-issue arc. So we should probably have a look at that at some point in the future.
Okay. Well, I'll get through the 12 issues following the ones that we just read. And I've got to say, though, if you are interested in picking up the Absolute Edition, at the back of this thing, there is another, another 60-odd pages worth of bonus material that includes his original proposal for the series, concept artwork, some beautiful concept artwork, just random stuff that never appears in the book, his scripts as well. Oh, so you actually, the scripts are great because you get a sense of his language and how he actually describes things. For example, I want him sitting at Oberon's feet or squatting more like resting on his toes with his legs akimbo and his arms hanging between them and Oberon resting on his hand on Puck's furry hair, scratching and stroking it through the performance. Puck is all sense of humour, untamed, eyes glowing. If you were close and going to cast the DC Comics performance of mine, Puck would probably be played by the Creeper, if you see what I mean. You know, he's kind of got these very descriptive ways of instructing the artist as to exactly what he wants, and other things are much shorter. But it is a masterclass in writing as well, by picking up this thing at the back, and you actually have the concept sketches of each panel on the opposite page to his script. So it is a great way of seeing how a comic is actually ultimately put together as well.
I've got to have a look at that book next time I see you at some stage.
Absolutely.
So, it sounds like a really good collection. We're out of time, dude.
Oh, wow.
I know. It just flies by when you're having fun. So we're going to have to leave the talk about the New 52 and what we're going to drop for next week. But that's okay. That'll give us a chance to get through issue threes.
Absolutely. And by then we know definitely what we're going to drop.
Absolutely. I think issue three is the magic number. I can actually tell you one right now. I think I'm dropping OMAC, which really doesn't do anything for me.
Didn't even grab me from the start. Like, no. There's actually a couple of issues I think I'll drop. More than a couple.
I'm probably going to drop Demon Knights. Although, very interestingly enough, Ertigan actually appeared in Sandman.
Yes, he did. He was in the thing, and it's where they actually introduced the idea of there being levels of demon in hell, and like the Rhymer demons, well, obviously a higher caste of demons than some of the other demons that were introduced there, and the whole thing about Etrigan rhyming throughout the thing has been a constant throughout every time he's appeared.
The other thing that this series did was it also made me really want to read Hellblazer. It made me really want to go back and read the John Constantine stuff.
I've read the early Hellblazers, and I've not read them for a while, so maybe that's definitely one we should put on our list for later.
I think, I've only my experience with John Constantine are usually within tie-ins, but not it's his own book.
Exactly.
Because he often comes into the Zatanna's world and stuff like that. So I've seen him and I've experienced him, but it makes me really want to read his books. So,
definitely.
Look, I recommend it. Go out, grab yourself a copy of Sandman. These volumes sound like the way to go. I believe they're also available digitally, though. So go out, grab them, read it. It's deep, but it's good. It's good fun.
So what are we doing next week, David?
Well, at the request of my son, actually, he wants us to do the Kevin Smith miniseries Batman Cacophony.
Good one. I have read that.
I have too. I'm going to reread it again, though. It's a good read, and it's a very fast read. It's only three issues, I really like the portrayal of Joker in Cacophony. So I think we'll...
Yes, which is definitely something worth talking about.
Yeah, I think we'll talk about that in great detail when we come back. So everybody go out, grab yourself the three issues of Cacophony. So Batman Cacophony, written by Kevin Smith, and we will discuss that next week as our book. It's going to be a lot smaller read than reading the eight issues of Sandman, let me tell you.
Definitely. Almost what we can do in the few hours before the show.
Yeah, absolutely. I was like, we were recording at 8, I'll start reading at 7.
Exactly. Yeah.
If you agree, disagree, want to put in your two bits, have any books that you want us to cover, want us to answer any questions, do any of that sort of stuff, we have a feedback line. It is comics@geekactually.com. Send us your feedback. We'd love to hear from you. Also about the show in itself, as I said, it is a beta show. We're still building it. We're still trying to find our feet and getting this all organized. So this was kind of like the... This is kind of like the structure we were going for, though. News at the head of the show, book club in the second half. You know, we're kind of getting there.
We just need a few little bits and pieces in there, just a few. If anybody out there who's a marvel with mixing sound wants to put a few themes together for us, just to introduce our film news or our comics news or just little segments that we have going through, please drop us a line at comics@geekactually.com.
That's the one.
And let us know that you're willing to offer your services, and we'll feature them on the show and get this tightness happening.
Absolutely. I really enjoyed discussing out Sandman. This has been a lot of fun.
It's been great.
Okay, so I think that's it. Now, just to let you all know that our feed and our iTunes link and everything is all active now. It's all running. Everything is fine. I looked at it just earlier on. The picture art is there and everything. So please, if you are an iTunes user, please leave us some feedback. Because we've got the numbers. What we need is a bunch of feedback on there, and then we can get up onto the new and noteworthy page.
Damn straight. So please, as David said, if you like us, leave us a rating. And if you don't like us, we don't want to hear from you.
Yeah, okay, that's one way of putting it. Sounds good to me.
Constructive criticism is how, as David said, we're in beta at the moment. We're going to build on this thing every single week.
Now, this is what we've actually said on the other shows, and I think it's important we say it on this show. If you have comments about the show in general, like the whole thing, multiple episodes, what you think of this show, whether it be positive or negative, that's when you put feedback on iTunes. If you have individual gripes about shows or things that we've said and lots of stuff, that's when you send us email. Because you don't just put those individual gripes up on iTunes, because then they're just going to stay there forever, and that's pointless. So
forever is a long time.
Forever is a long time. So if it's like individual things, like you go, oh man, your intro music sucks, that doesn't go on iTunes. That comes to us, you know what I mean? Because we can fix that.
Absolutely. And we will be fixing that.
And sure. We will. As I was pointing out to Richard, we've started with a different theme every week, and this week will be no different, I'm sure. All right, so everybody, thank you very much for listening. Richard, it's been a pleasure again.
As always, Mr. McVeigh.
And we will do it all again next week with Batman Cacophony. And I think that's all I've got. I think we can call this a show.
Let's wrap it up and call it Christmas.
Do you know what we need? We need a funky sign-off.
Yeah.
I don't have one.
We need something. On the old Geek Actually show, may it rest in peace, we used to say Geek On.
Absolutely.
At the end. So maybe that's appropriate for this as well.
Kind of nerd on,
right? Nerd on.
That sounds a little bit too close. No, we won't get into that.
Oh, exactly right.
All right. Well, we better get out of here. We're running a little bit over time today, actually. So thank you very much for listening, and we'll see you all next week. Bye, Richard.
Bye.
Well, if you enjoyed this and you want to find out more about us, you can find me at geekactually.com, or you can follow me at David McVeigh on Twitter.
And you can find me at therealbits.com. That's REELBits.com. Or you can just follow me on Twitter constantly at DVDBits. Forever a spider can spins away.